From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Modern Literary History and Criticism, this week on Soundings. My guest is David Dachies of the University of Sussex. David Dachies is the author of more than 30 books of literary history and criticism. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he's at work on a forthcoming study of the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment on the founders of the United States. David Dachies, welcome to Soundings. We're going to talk about literature and literary criticism. A lot of talk these days about the confusion, the disparity, the tensions, the gaps, whatever, between the artist and the critic. Is it true that they are one and the same?
Of course they're not one and the same. Otherwise, there would be no such thing as criticism. Criticism has an object to devote itself to. I find myself very puzzled by the insistence in some quarters today that a work of art can mean anything that a critic would like it to mean. This seems to me a kind of systematized flattery of illiteracy. Uh-huh. It doesn't matter if you don't know anything. Whatever the work means to you is okay.
We've got critics who are sort of like Adam in the Garden of Eden. They're just naming things and seeing if they can get away with it. Is that going too far?
Well, no, it's not going far enough, because Adam at least knew what he was naming. I mean, if I produce to you a text by Confucius in Chinese, assuming you don't know Chinese, you might say, well, that's a very pretty pattern. I like the little squiggles on the left, and there's a very nice line down the middle there. And if I hold it up to the light, I get a real aesthetic thrill. Now, are you telling me, or are these critics telling me, that it is okay to say that is what Confucius means? Mm-hmm. Now, that is the logical conclusion of some of the theories that some modern critics are putting forward.
Well, David Dachies, let's talk about where all this came from. Can we use a large rubric such as traditional criticism? How would you characterize what we have departed from? Help me with that.
Well, I think there have been movements. One doesn't want to go back to Aristotle or anything like that. But the tradition, for example, that I grew up with, roughly the sort of Matthew Arnold tradition. Literature is a humane projection of insights into the human situation, using the texture and structure of language to achieve resonances and meanings, and so illuminate, encourage, increase our understanding and our awareness, and at the same time give us pleasure because of the pattern of the work is itself pleasing. That's a very crude paraphrase of what one might call the Matthew Arnold tradition.
Arnold, for instance, uses the word touchstone to help us identify what great works, great thoughts, our cultural inheritance. That sounds pretty safe and rational and logical. Why is it that we have gotten away from, have we indeed gotten away from such a notion?
Oh, yes, but that raises a different question. There's the larger question of Arnold's view of literature as an illumination and illustration of aspects of what one might call the human situation. There is the smaller question of whether you can gauge a work of literature by taking out a line or two, and because your hair bristles when you read it or hear it, you say, ah, that is the authentic voice of true literature. There are critics who objected to Arnold's touchstone theory because they thought it didn't do justice to the structure and pattern of literature and just picked out the odd line, while at the same time agreeing with his general principle.
This word voice that you use, that's important. Narrative voice, for instance, that's important amongst many of the people who produce literature, the original expressive voice or artist and the critic. We have a legitimate complaint there, I would say, on the part of some of these more recent critics who say, how can we figure out who is speaking and to whom? And therefore, we have disputes about the message, something that comes off the printed page to us. In general strokes, help me to understand some of the problems there.
Well, in the first place, one has a pre-critical duty to learn the language. As I said, a page of Chinese to someone who doesn't know Chinese may be aesthetically very beautiful, but it's got nothing whatever to do with the literary value of that work or that poem or whatever it happens to be. So we have a preliminary duty to learn the language. Now, that is, of course, is not as easy as you might think, even if you're referring to your own native language, because language changes. The meaning of words changes, the suggestions, the overtones, the references, the whole cultural background of language changes. So that as a teacher of literature, for example, if I were teaching Shakespeare or Milton or even Tennyson or even Auden or Eliot, I would feel it a primary duty to put my students in a position where they can hear the language properly that the person was using. Mm-hmm. Now, you can never do this 100%, particularly as you become more and more towards the modern period when private references, for all sorts of cultural reasons, as you find in Eliot, become much more dominant than what one might call public references of the kind you get in Tennyson with his classical allusions and his references to what he thought were known myths and known situations. So, but you must try to make people understand that when Pope uses the word nature, he means something different from what Wordsworth meant. That is some guarantee that the voice you're listening to is the voice you were meant to listen to.
All right. Now, when a critic, let's pause on this example, the word nature. We move from Alexander Pope in the 18th century to Wordsworth in the early part of the 19th. Give me just a brief overview. What have the critics said about the usages of that word? And how is it that modern criticism, veers away from those two understandings of our conception of this large concept of nature in poetry?
Well, nature is one of the prime examples of shifts in meaning from medieval times to Shakespeare's time to Pope's time to Wordsworth's time to our own time. And the reason why people shift away from that is that it's too difficult. They just don't want to be bothered. They don't know enough. They resent the intellectual discipline that is necessary to learn the shifts in the language so that you can hear the proper resonances. So there's a kind of mindless egalitarianism going on here. They say, you know, my view is as good as you. I know damn all about it. But why? It's elitist to say that you, because you know more about it, your reading is more correct. That seems to me to be the death of all understanding and all education.
Well, now, one of the problems underlying these critical tensions, as we understand them in the 1980s, is is it the injection of ideological assumptions and biases into literature, the uses of literature, or is there anything really new about that? Haven't writers and critics always brought to literary expression and interpretation certain ideological spins and twists?
There have always been ideological and indeed political elements in literature of any significance at all, in Shakespeare's tragedies and comedies, in Milton's Paradise Lost. Wherever you look, in the past as in the present, there are political and ideological overtones. Sometimes they're more overt and more significant. Sometimes they're less clearly defined, but they're always there, because politics and ideology are permanent interests of the human mind. The way people are organized in society, the basic notions of the structure of the universe and of our own minds, these are always with us. And there's nothing new about saying that ideology and politics are prominent or play some part in our response to literature. What is new is blocking off all the other parts.
In other words, we're eliminating many possibilities rather than adding them. Now, that sounds like a bit of an irony, because, or at least a paradox, because many of these modern literary theorists tell us that they are, the phrase is, opening the canon. They are looking at different kinds of literature. They're looking at the expressive voice of women and minorities. And we would seem to have, an enrichment of our understanding of literary inheritance in those terms. But you're telling me, no, they're shutting off all but one or two possible interpretations.
Well, I wouldn't say, not saying they're always doing that, but there would seem to be a danger in doing that. You see, it seems to me that any ideology and any political view, if expressed with sufficient literary skill and richness and resonance, can produce some kind of illumination and increased awareness of, to use this corny phrase, the human situation. Here we are, human beings in a world we never made, full of all kinds of conflicting emotions and desires, trying to come to terms with ourselves, our relationships with our friends and lovers, with the green world of nature, with human society, with our own mortality, which is a very difficult thing to come to terms with. And great works of literature explore the ways in which we can try to come to terms with these paradoxes and problems and difficulties and ironies and confusions of life. Now, you can do this through any number of ideologies. I mean, Milton's Paradise Lost is written in a Christian framework. You don't have to believe what he believed to appreciate it, because these are devices. They're languages, if you like, just as you don't have to believe in Homer's Greek gods to understand the poignant human dimension of a Homeric poem. These are ways in which you can enter into an increased awareness of some of the paradoxes of the human situation that I was talking about. You don't have to believe in them, but they have to be viable.
By contrast, many of the modern literary critics are telling us that language itself is so fragile, so difficult, that the language itself is the difficulty, not the intention of the writer and not our desire as consumers of literature to understand it. Hasn't that always been the case? Language is an imperfect instrument. We'll never really fully understand it, conquer it, whatever.
Of course, it has always been the case. No understanding of a work of literature can ever be 100%. You can never be sure that you've caught all the reverberations, all the resonances, all the meanings. And there is always scope for further critical analysis. There is no limit to what you can say about a Shakespeare play or a Jane Austen novel. There is a limit to what you can say about a bawdy limerick. There are differences in scope and value, and it's not elitist to say that Hamlet is better than some recent bestseller. You can demonstrate it, even though you cannot give a final 100% reading of Hamlet and say that's what it means. But may I just add one thing? Sophocles' Oedipus Rex is not a comedy about sex, and Shakespeare's King Lear is not a manual of geriatric treatment. And if you read either of these plays as those things, you're just being silly.
David Deitch, a moment ago in the same breath, you mentioned Hamlet and body limericks or lyrics. One of the problems that we confront in approaching literature today is a kind of a blurring of the line between what we used to call, still do, I suppose, high and low art, popular culture, and a kind of an elitist expression of literature. Does this bother you? Do you find this something of a challenge to figure out the differences and reconcile them critically?
It's very interesting that one uses the terms high and low art, and you make the point that critics are now trying to say there is no real significant difference in the value of both, because I would say that is not where the distinction lies. I would put it much more simply, in good and bad. There is very good low art, and there's appallingly bad high art. There's right. pretentious art. There is a great number of epics, long forgotten, written in the 17th and 18th centuries, are very high art. Wilkie's Epigoniad, I bet you've never even heard of it.
Yeah, you're right.
Which was a Homeric poem written by a minor poet in Scotland in the 18th century, which is totally unreadable. That was the highest possible kind of art.
You mean formally speaking?
Oh, yes, it was
or in
epic.
Terms of its content?
Both. It was meant to be genuine. Homeric, his contemporaries called him the Scottish Homer. Nobody reads him today. But Robert Burns, at the same time, wrote a little poem called To a Louse, and about seeing a louse in a lady's bonnet. That is low art, and it's superb.
Yeah, and it survives.
And it survives. So the difference isn't between high and low. It's between quality. It's between good and silly or worthless or sloppy or pretentious or whatever. One can only say as honestly as one can, with using all the intellectual resources one has, reading as widely and as sympathetically as one possibly can manage to do, one can only say what literature is meant to oneself. And if one must tell the truth about this. Mm-hmm. One can pretend to be in fashion. One can use jargon that is fashionable today. And I've done that in my time, too. When I was a young man, I was a great user of fashionable jargon. But as one grows older, one grows more, I hope one grows wiser. Mm-hmm. I hope one is able to stand a little aside from fashionableness and try to be honest with oneself and come to terms with the insights one has developed.
Give me a specific and concrete example, David Deches. Can you point to a work of literature, a poem or a novel, a play, about which you have, if not radically, then appreciably changed your understanding, your critical approach? You've mentioned Shakespeare, and you've talked about Pope and Arnold, people like that. How, for example, did you look at Shakespeare early on? Have you changed your mind about him? What critical approaches have you got in mind?
Oh, I've learned an awful lot more about Shakespeare in the course of my reading him and teaching him, but I'm not one of those people, and this may sound rather stuffy, but it's just true, who look back and say, oh, Shakespeare was spoiled for me at school. I just hated being taught him. Certainly in Britain today, you get people say that. Uh-huh. I found him exciting. The very first Shakespeare play I read when I was at high school was Julius Caesar. And I was absolutely carried away by Anthony's speech. I didn't really fully understand the play and its subtleties and paradoxes. I've written a little book about Julius Caesar since then, because it's haunted my imagination ever since. But the language, the rhetoric, I think, is what really sent me. Mm-hmm. And I've changed my mind a great deal about Shakespeare, but not about his quality, about what he's really doing. The very first time I read John Donne, I was an undergraduate at Edinburgh University, and our professor, H.J.C. Grierson, was the great editor of Donne. And he was waxing eloquent about Donne, and I read some of Donne's poems, and I said, this is mystifying nonsense, in my youthful arrogance. I changed my mind about that. Uh-huh. Donne, to me, is one of the most haunting and memorable and marvelous of poets. Mm-hmm. The very first time I looked at Joyce's Ulysses, I could make nothing of it.
Oh, goodness.
But my gosh, it's become my passion now. I think it, to me, is one of the greatest books ever written. Uh-huh. And I've written about it, and I've taught it, and I've read it, and I reread it. I'm not a Finnegan's Wake man. I'm a Ulysses man. Uh-huh. I think the law of diminishing returns has begun to apply when you get to Finnegan's Wake. Though I sometimes think that Finnegan's Wake is the ideal work for some modern critics, because you can really make it mean anything you like.
Mm-hmm. Let me put a wonderful and perhaps dangerous word on the table here, David Deches. We're talking about literature and literary criticism. The word is relevance, that literature somehow or other is going to help us, if not save us, that it's going to move us beyond the baser elements in our human nature, that it's going to move us toward the noble. There's, of course, arguments on both sides of that issue. How does the critic, how do you approach that kind of a question? Do you look at literature and say, well, you know, it's fun to read, it's lovely, it's aesthetically pleasing, but it doesn't necessarily improve me? It seems to me that I hear you saying that it should, that it can.
There are two separate questions here, I think. One is whether literature is relevant, and the other is whether it's edifying. Hmm. Now, in the Arnold tradition, you would say it was both. It somehow improves us, not necessarily morally, but Arnold really thought that poetry would replace religion to console us. Mm-hmm. As a great edifying and consoling power. I don't believe that. I don't think that literature has any single function of that kind. It can console us, it can amuse us, it can exasperate us, it can infuriate us, it can encourage us, it can do all sorts of things. But I would insist that it must be relevant, and if it isn't relevant, then chuck it. I mean, life is short enough, and there are enough things to do. If you don't find it relevant in however away. I mean, amusing, but relevant to yourself as a living and thinking and feeling and suffering and enjoying human being. If it's not relevant, then life is too short to accommodate it. It may be relevant as play, but still relevant.
Homo ludens.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm a great believer in literature as play, among other things.
It's been said, David Deitches, that a lot of literary criticism today is anti-humanistic, that it is one critic, Cleanth Brooks, goes so far as to say that some of the critical theories that are floating around today, deconstruction, for example, which is an immensely complicated topic by itself, is nihilistic, that it denies rather than affirms. Do you go that far?
Well, I know what Cleanth means. I don't think I myself would quite use that word, but I would agree with some of the implications of his use of it. That is to say that it denies any difference between one work and another. It denies the concept of quality, and it denies the concept of stability of meaning. Anything may mean anything. Well, that is nihilism, I suppose. At least it's pretty odd.
Well, it's verbal gamesmanship taken right to the very brink. How should we read literature? There's an immense question. Is there a particular kind of mindset that we bring to it?
How should we read it? With enjoyment and responsiveness. I mean, you mentioned a little while ago something about in the past the critics have ignored women's literature. Well, they haven't really. There have been an awful lot written about Jane Austen. I myself have written a book about Virginia Woolf, and I've written a book about Willa Cather. And I've written an essay on Catherine Mansfield. It never occurred to me that I was engaged in writing about women's literature, though one is aware that there are certain kinds of sensibility, certain kinds of ironies, certain ways of looking at things that are feminine rather than masculine. But this is all in the day's work for a critic, I think.
Well, what is this? When we talk about women's literature or minority literature, do we have here a reflection more of academic turf squabbles than we do of the literary enterprise itself?
Oh, I think we have a reverberation from the whole feminist movement, of course, and the fight for political equality for blacks comes into literature as well. I think you are much more likely to assert the equality of women's literature and black literature if you don't use those categories. Literature is literature. I concede, no one knows better than I do, that there are qualities of sets of mind that you find in Jane Austen, in Virginia Woolf, and so on, that you don't find in their male contemporaries, but they come out as literature, and any valid approach will show what they are.
What about the charge that that the academic enterprise of literature has been a white male bastion and is therefore inherently prejudicial to these other expressive voices?
I don't think this is true. More good novels have been written by women than by men. People read Fanny Burney and Virginia Woolf and George Eliot and Willa Cather and lots of others, and they have for quite a long time. I find this charge not really valid. I think it's a feedback from a political fight, and people want to push it into the literary dimension. Mind you, there are some critics, they just popped into my mind right now, who are prejudiced against women's literature. I'm thinking of George Saintsbury's remarks about George Eliot's later novels, as sort of wordy and a sort of blue stocking lady on the loose is pretty well how he thought of Middlemarch. Those weren't quite his words. He didn't understand the later George Eliot at all. I think Middlemarch is one of the great novels in the English language. And again, I've written a book on Middlemarch, so I've done my share in women's literature. But you see, I don't think there's a special literary category. I think there is a special psychological category. I mean, there is English literature and there's American literature. There is Jewish literature. Mm-hmm. But there isn't a literature of long-nosed people or literature of bald men. That would be an unreal category. Uh-huh. And so you must distinguish between real and unreal categories when you make these distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Footnote to our conversation, David Dacis, some critics have told us for a long time that the novel is about to die, that it's expired, that sort of thing. Let's take that a couple of steps beyond. What's the, how would you gauge the health of literature as an enterprise? You look back on a career of literary criticism. Are we entering into a bright new age, or are we in transition? We're always in transition. Help me with that.
Well, the first place, the novel has been dying ever since I can remember. When Joyce first wrote, people said, the novel is now really dead. I think the novel is in very good health at the moment. No, I think that literature like sex is here to stay. Mm-hmm. And it will find different ways of manifesting itself. It is one of the profoundest of human urges. And to come back to the popular versus the high art thing again, there are ballads and folk stories and things that bubble up from all kinds of levels, what patronizingly one might say levels from down below, mm-hmm. that continually giving new dimension to literature. Literature has always strengthened itself by feeding on semi-literate traditions, barbarous traditions, street traditions. Some of the most interesting fiction in my own country of Scotland is the Glasgow novel ebbing out of the semi-literate street life of what we call the Keelys, the street urchins. Mm-hmm. And it's given a new dimension to dialogue and to language and to an understanding of society.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about modern literary history and criticism. My guest was David Dacis of the University of Sussex. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Dacis is at work on a forthcoming study of the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment on the founders of the United States. Soundings on Literary History and Criticism is available on cassette. Ask for program number 396. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. That's program number 396. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of discussions about education in the United States. My guests will be Charles Blitzer, the director of the National Humanities Center, and Lynn V. Cheney, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The poet, the poem, and the reader. Next on Soundings. Listen for David Dacis of the University of Sussex. Are critic and artist one and the same? How does each speak to the reader? Modern literary history and criticism. Some answers and insights from literary historian David Dacis. This week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center.